Welcome back to part two of my Ruddy Borneo podcast. To recap, a semi-conscious venture was being slowly dragged out of the jungle as darkness was fast setting in, a situation we were not prepared for. We decided to split the group. I ran ahead with a venturer, while the other PMs and another venturer worked hard to get the casualty out of the descending darkness. We found the venturers who had gone on ahead and mobilized a stretcher team, equipped with lights, to get the casualty out of the jungle. I got on the radio to our headquarters to coordinate a potential evacuation of the casualty. And before long, thankfully, we had the venturer out of the jungle just before it got dark. We got confirmation from the medic at headquarters that the casualty was suffering from severe dehydration, but it wasn't heat exhaustion, which would have been very, very serious. And through all the hard work, fortunately, by 10 p.m, the venturer was fully conscious and back on the mend. But that wasn't the end of the situation. Tensions were really simmering. There was a divide between the team that were left behind with the venturer, the jungle heroes in inverted commas, and the venturers who had left us behind, and naturally had a more limited role in the rescue of the casualty. And the bigger question in everyone's minds was, who was at fault? We decided we needed a meeting to get these emotions out in the open. I'm quickly going to touch on what we discussed at that meeting, because to me it was a fascinating and very difficult conversation, and one you don't ordinarily get to have. The venturers went into the meeting on the defensive, expecting the blame to be put on them. But as a PM team, we initially took responsibility for what had happened, and we hoped also that the venturers would follow suit and take responsibility themselves. Here's how the other PMs remember it.
You started proceedings, and you were saying how you felt that perhaps you'd failed in several aspects of being a PM, and I followed after you, and unfortunately I just burst into tears, and it changed the tone of the entire review.
Because they were thinking, okay, we are guilty, that's it,
let's review
for that time. There were like more important lessons.
I think it showed a side of the PMs that they weren't expecting. Perhaps it's an age thing, that they don't expect people to be so forthcoming with emotions, particularly to failure.
And I felt some of them struggled to place blame on themselves. It's a very difficult thing to take the blame for yourself.
I think one of the hardest parts of it was that some of them showed very little feeling towards it anyway. So one of the responses, rather than being a life lesson or like feelings to do with the situation, was shit happens.
Yeah.
Oh, shit happens, you know, somebody nearly died in the jungle.
Yeah.
That's not shit happens. That was really, really frustrating.
But when all was said and done, we really felt the experience brought some really positive points.
In hindsight, it really demonstrated how well we all worked as a team, and it really brought us together, even in the aftermath when we had to have a review session with the entire group. And I think if we hadn't had that, then the group would have just entirely fractured for the last couple of days of phase.
So we've seen the dark, dangerous side of the jungle. Let's now turn to why they're so special and what's threatening them. It's a well-known story that Borneo's rainforests are under threat. But looking at a satellite image of the island, the entire island seems to be covered in trees. Up in the hinterlands, the higher plains of the Bornean forest, there are swathes of untouched, pristine rainforest. But the majority of Borneo's wildlife resides in forests of a lower altitude, also known as the lowland forest. That's where the highly endangered rhinos, orangutans, elephants, and myriad of other mammals live. Now, it is possible to log these forests in such a way to allow the forest to regenerate faster, so-called low-impact logging. And research suggests secondary rainforest, i.e. primary rainforest that's been logged, can still harbour significant biodiversity. But one of the biggest threats to biodiversity is palm oil. The oil from palm fruits are used in products ranging from food to cosmetics, and it's very profitable. And you could argue that it's still trees that are being planted where the rainforest used to be, so it can't be that bad, right? The issue is that palm oil plantations harbour a fraction of the number of species that rainforests contain. It's a biological desert, and they can't be recovered. Once land's been converted to palm oil, it's very difficult for rainforests to grow back on the same land. So, what does Danone Valley have to do with it all? Danone Valley is 438 square kilometres of untouched, pristine, lowland primary rainforest. It's a seed bank. It contains an incredible diversity of wildlife. And while efforts are made to limit the irreversible destructions of Borneo's rainforests, there exists a patch of land where the blueprint for the rainforest will remain protected. I'll try to convey how amazing it is. The trees are spectacular. A big difference between primary and secondary rainforest are the tree species. Secondary rainforests grow back quite quickly and the trees will reach a height of about 40 meters. But in a primary rainforest, the slower growing but bigger, taller trees push out the faster growing and shorter trees and reach heights of up to 75 meters. They are the skyscrapers of Jungle City, casting a shadow over the entire forest. And from a distance, they burst out of the canopy and reach high into the sky, stretching far and wide in every direction. While working in the jungle, you'd regularly see completely new insects and plants. Ripe purple millipedes, stick insects that look like leaves, half-meter thick vines that wind their way up to the top of the skyscraper trees, flying insects that must have been the inspiration for the monster in the film Predator. I mean, the list goes on and on. And many of them would even visit the camp.
Oh, the cat. There was like a civic cat. It was first it was in the sink, in your kitchen. I think it's the slowest cat I've ever seen. We have Boris, the boar.
Boris the boar, yeah.
He's so ugly.
And the sounds of the jungle are incredible. Although you can mostly see trees around you, the hum of activity is a constant reminder that you are not alone. Now here's the background hum during the day. Overall, quite quiet. Now, compare that to the magic of the night. Close your eyes, imagine you're in a hammock. You can't see a thing, it's completely pitch black. And here's the insect nightclub all around you. And daybreak is special again. The midnight party is wound down, and the gibbons begin recounting their exploits from the night before. And then, like clockwork, the jungle alarm goes off at 6 a.m. on the dot. Raleigh's been involved with Denham Valley for many years, building infrastructure such as rangers' cabins and bridges. The conservation areas really value Raleigh's work. Their parent company, Yayasan Sabah, has limited resources and makes most of its money from logging and, in the near future, palm oil. So all infrastructure Raleigh builds supports the protection of the forests and raises awareness of their ecological importance. In the last expedition, a cabin was built in the heart of Denham Valley, 17 kilometers into the middle of primary rainforest. And as I mentioned before, Raleigh's goal in this expedition was to repair a suspension bridge. But before we could fix the bridge, we had to trek into the middle of Denham Valley to retrieve a bunch of tools, many of which would be useful for fixing the bridge. When the cabin was built in the last expedition, the group were going to take the tools with them. However, there was a medical emergency and the team had to be helicoptered out.
So we packed our bags and put them on the bus.
Except for James, the forgetful twat.
So we packed our bags and put them on the bus. Trek to Denham Valley. It was the worst trek in the world. It was the worst trek in the world. Look into the jungle and you will see James and Nick and Naomi.
The trek took 7 days, and it was bloody hard work. And for many, it was their hardest moment on Raleigh. The biggest day was an epic 10-kilometer, 9-hour marathon. This is how one venture describes the trek.
Hell Hill on Denham was definitely my hardest challenge. I kind of forgot how vertical it was until we came down, and I was like, how did anyone get up this, let alone us, like, let alone me, getting it, like, it was just crazy. It was like, and you were just trying to find, like, trees to, like, hold on and pull yourself up with.
We set off at 7 in the morning, had half a lunch for 20 minutes around midday, and then stumbled into the cabin at just before 4 in the afternoon, just pumping on adrenaline. We were covered in leeches and blood was just pouring out everywhere. It was complete carnage. So I pulled out the microphone as we stumbled into camp and I got everyone's reactions.
I'm really, really exhausted, but I'm so glad that I have the T-proof.
At 2.5 kilometers to go, I actually thought I was on the verge of collapse and I didn't think I was actually going to be able to walk anymore.
I'm actually really, really, really proud of myself, especially because Nick told us it was the hardest trek of her life and she's done lots and lots of trekking.
Yeah. So Bobby told me that this is the hardest thing you've done.
I will slap you if you do not get the microphone out of my face.
I think that's I think that is the definition of hangry.
Bug someone else.
Definition of hangry right there.
I have been violated by leeches. That was the word. Violated.
Look down your boot and they're like 10 litres in.
That's not even the bad boot. Oh, my bad foot. This is the next one to come.
Oh my god!
Holy fuck!
Oh my god!
I think I'm gonna Sierra 15 again.
Oh!
Everything down there is red.
After returning from the deep recesses of the jungle, we began fixing the bridge. Why? Well, the foundations on one side had been washed away due to a mudslide, tilting the walkway and making it quite dangerous to cross. We were fixing the bridge to create a circular route and give scientists and naturalists better access to the jungle. To fix the bridge, we hauled rocks from the beach by the river 40 meters up the mountainside and then placed them in metal cages, also known as gabions. It was incredibly monotonous work and physically exhausting. 15 days of heavy rock lifting. As a group, keeping up morale was quite difficult. The day we finished rock collecting, I whipped out the microphone and captured everyone's sentiments. You know, I was expecting them to be ecstatic, you know, reflecting on the value of perseverance and teamwork and taking away some really valuable life lessons. But that's not how they felt. Not in the slightest. In fact, here is how they actually felt, in their own words.
What have you learned about yourself collecting rocks?
I don't want to do carrying rocks as a job.
Oh, so Dave, tell me about rocks.
Rocks, oh, yeah. Fuck.
What?
I hate them.
What do you mean you hate them?
I hate rocks. After this phase, I don't see another rock in my life, to be honest.
And what have you learned about life and yourself collecting rocks for the past week?
Absolutely nothing. It doesn't help anything in my life. I still hate rocks, I hate carrying them up, and I hate building bridges. So yeah, that's why.
We're not even building a bridge. We're putting rocks in a cage.
Yeah, fuck, I feel like a c***.
Finding way to be dragged through the bridge, and it was easy to see. It was the worst bridge in the world. It was the worst bridge in the world. Once every 100,000 trips or so.
And now let's dip into my favourite topic, personal development. Rally is a sustainable development charity, but it uses young people as it helps them develop as well. That was one of the main reasons I came, experience at people management. If you ask anybody who knew me before university, they would have said I was as emotionally perceptive as a doorknob, which is why I relished a challenge of trying to help venturers from a personal development perspective. We would have one-to-ones at the beginning and end of each phase, and feedback sessions when venturers took turns to be leaders of the group. I found helping venturers with personal development to be very challenging. I mean, I had zero experience in this field. But I thought back to the best managers I had when working in finance in London. They would always devote time to you, genuinely cared about your development, and this in turn inspired loyalty and commitment from me. So I think I adopted a similar style. I asked many questions and let conversations go where they needed to. It was my job to listen closely and paint a map of their strengths and weaknesses across the feedback categories.
Sitting in on them on phase three and when we were doing 3-to-1s was quite interesting, and especially you'd really thought it out for it to be on their own terms. You encourage them to talk as opposed to giving them direction, which I suppose would be more like a teacher.
I chose to push myself out of my comfort zone and took on the most challenging one-to-ones and had some of the most difficult conversations I've ever had in my life. But on the back of these, I began to receive very positive feedback from other project managers who had my old venturers, and my confidence started to grow. Of all the venturers I devoted time to, there is one that is quite close to my heart, and in my personal opinion, I felt I helped the most. He was a wonderful guy, intelligent and considerate. He came to Rally to overcome his issues with self-doubt. Our initial one-to-one set a record for length, almost 3 hours of intense conversation. But I feel we got close to the root of the problem, and I offered him some potential solutions to deal with it. And the result? Well, I'll let him explain.
I think loads of people are misunderstanding that the one-to-one was long, so it must have been quite bad. But in my opinion, the 2 hours 50 was one of the most precious times I could get from this whole expedition, because you gave me a new way of trying to change my mindset, and you've given examples of people's lives and how they didn't view it in a negative way, that what I've been doing up to now. I'm steadily accepting what people are complimenting me, and by, as you said, trying to say what I've done right on that day, what I've done good. It's these little things which you've been helping me and you've been giving me advice on, is, I think, is changing my path in life.
Once every 100 days or so, a man comes out and bites some toes, so Felix had to go. Bye bye, goat.
And so Rally came to an end. Over the 3 months, a very odd and quite exotic ginger plant was grown on my face. And its existence drew a rather mixed reaction.
Kind of like a orangutan's pubes.
Is it any old orangutan?
No, like a dirty, dirty, muddy, filthy orangutan.
There's a lot of stray cats around my flat in Wimbledon. And then there's this one ginger cat which always scratches on my door whenever we cook fish. And it's missing, it has bald patches around it. Yes, it reminds me of that ginger cat.
And that's it. It's been a mad, wonderful experience. This podcast could have easily lasted hours. This is literally just scratching the surface of my experience, let alone everybody else's wonderful moments. Would I do it again? Yes. Do I recommend it to everyone? Yes. Just get out there. My next steps? India. Thanks for listening.